Anyway, that's from the TA. Welcome everybody to the DG. Can we start? It's 2:10. The first thing to it before the committee is formally announced would be I've got apologies from Gabe van Rooyen. He's got a family matter to attend to. He will come to Parliament this afternoon. So, what he has done is, I think, something that MP members need to do. If for some reason you cannot come and you negotiate with the whip in the committee and it's agreed to, you should arrange when you're voting on this for somebody to substitute for you. Now, Mr. Van Rooyen has done exactly that. In fact, he's lifted it to work here and he's going to be back. He's going to come back in about 20 past. So, maybe the DA wants to do the whole thing, but we can't recognize you. We can raise it with the ANC. Now, the issue of bills to be pointed out is the Banks Amendment Law, because I went through it last night and it's exactly what we agreed to do. FFC bills seems to be some glitches here and there, but maybe I'm wrong. So, can we look at the Banks Amendment Bill? Colin, what we have done is we've told, where's Mr. Jenkins? He's not here. He's got his way. Mr. Jenkins is on his way. That's the best way of dealing with a bill, the simplest way of dealing with a bill, we do have a card so we can vote shopping, is to actually look at the draft B version, because it has the original bill with all the amendments. So what I suggest we do is look at B17B. Right, have you got it? B17B? Right. So I'm going to take you through the book informally very quickly. On the aims of the bill, any comments? I would imagine that there is a few, because exactly what we had. On First Amendment 1. Clause 1 on page 2, no comments. Clause 2. Right, no comments. Yeah, we're on clause 3 now. On page 5. Any comments? No, right. So, can we vote on the bill? I read you the... let's vote on the bill itself. Clause 1. Move a seconder. Okay, clause 2. With all the amendments, move a seconder. Good. Clause 3. Yeah, we know that. It's not against Senator right now. Clause 3, yeah. Okay, fine. Now, when we vote on the bill, it's always just say what you want to say.
I would request the honorable member from the DA to press, because I didn't say
anything. It's nothing profound or unusual, what you could have predicted.
Okay.
They're reserving their rights on the, to decide on the bill, as they always do. Right. Having said that, this clause 4 is obviously a similar one, right? So we're agreeing on all clauses. There's a movement in of a clause 4. Good. Right, done. Now the bill as a whole, we know that the DA reserves its position. Having noted that very profound statement, have we now got a movement in of the bill as a whole? Right. Having said that, I think the DG is here. Of course, welcome. Seconder was seconded. What I want to say is that, look, this bill is very challenging indeed. And we understand the commercial process underway for some sort of agreement between the contending parties. We actually hold the view the committee does that consistent with this bill as passed now in this committee, we would hope that that negotiation process will lead to an equitable outcome. Understand that there are friends and friends at stake here, and then it's always so reasonable. Having said that, I now read to you the report itself. The Standing Committee on Finance and consider to examine the Banks Amendment of B17-2014, National Assembly Section 75, refers to it and clarified by the JCM Section 75 law, reports the proposed amendment B17A-2014. The committee further reports that the Democratic Alliance reserves its position on the bill. Okay. Thank you. We're voting now on the report. Hold up. Thank you.
No.
Quite that's done. Now,
that about what you said must be in the object, isn't there?
Yes, yes, everything we've done is there.
Yeah.
Okay. Then on the irreceivable, here there are something that I'm going to ask very quickly before we go through this. I don't know, maybe I'm a bit out of the loop, right? So you can help here, but we look at the theme, one of the goals of the theme, the goal that runs into 21 pages, I think. Yep. Right. Now, very quickly on the, what you call the aim, on page 2. Now, just clarify to us again, to correctly describe the role of the FSC, right, is one of the aims. Then you make changes to the provisions dealing with the functions of the Commission to ensure the terminology is consistent with the Constitution. So those two aims. Don't be over that. So why don't just remove to correctly describe the role of the FSC, because it's too vague, right? At the beginning, that would be. Anybody else any comments? No? Okay.
I don't know where you are.
Now, page 2 of the... Okay. Everybody else on the board is looking. Page 2. Okay. Then can we leave this thing? Again, I'm sorry, ideally we should meet before the committee meets, so we can deal with these issues. But unfortunately, with the constituency period, yesterday being a holiday, and I'm only looking at some of this, I thought everything had been sorted out, I had a meeting with our members, but it's Parliament's job to actually ensure, not members of Parliament, the staff of Parliament, so I have to check all this, right? So here again, 21 years later, it's an MP that has to do this. It's unfair on me, and whoever else is looking at this, I really despair, actually. Alright, so here we are, you're saying, again, there's a sense we ask you to reformulate, right? And maybe there's no other way up, and at this stage, we won't die in the ditch. But do we know what he's saying? Why don't we write them please? To strengthen the requirements for organs of state concerning the Commission's recommendations on the assignment of a power or function by an organ of state in one sphere of government to an organ of state in another sphere of government.
I don't see that one.
Okay, on page 2, it's Roman semicolon 4. Is anything to do about it, we can give up.
So when is it agreed to with the body on the father as fine? Because we're doing a number of things in the provision. The one is to reduce the reference to advice. And then we all specifically say that they like indicate certain information in the memorandum that they must relate to the commission. And then also an active duty on them to request the advice from the commission. So it's all those things that we say in relation to when there's a transfer of function, what they should do in a preference condition. So that's, I know you can simplify reading further, but that's what we're trying to capture.
Really, it's very clear. You can't avoid these things. We've got the next semicolon to adjust the period for filling of vacancies in the Commission and to reveal a duplicate provision on the same subject matter, alternated. Why don't you say on the same matter? Why subject matter suddenly? We don't use that term unless there's a specific meaning given to it now. Well, I've never come across that term in all the years. Yes, sorry?
On the strengthening the requirements for organ of state, if there's so much we can do for the country and it's fair to it, yeah, can we have a land that is as referred to in section 7? Is it
possible? Well, you're right. We this thing has been raised in Parliament before, but then if you do that for one of the aims, you have to do it for all parties. This battle we lost at Haven on some years ago, I would just like to rule that this is changing the whole format. And I'm not trying to ask you to take it, we change the whole format of the it's a norm. And you guys are going to be up in arms. I agree with her, actually. Why are you raising these things, honey? For what it's worth, when we dealt with the municipal structure problem, we also said, why would we put it, but the aim is running into pages, and they said, if you do it now, it's going to set a basis, and nowhere do they go out in the world. Even writing simply can be done. For what it's worth, I went to Willie Hoffman in 1998, but he was responsible for what? Legislation made simple. Who was here in 1994? You see? I'm an expert now. There's nobody here. I'm getting old and lonely. But Willie Hoffman, by the way, just give some history, was very good, eh? If you saw simply our constitution written, it's marvelously simply written. It's an utter delight in its simplicity. you read other constitutions, Andy. In Europe and in London, that's what I do. You will never get something as beautifully written, as clearly and as simply written, right, as our constitution. William Hoffman was part of a team of MPs that played a role, together with experts. Was it called? What do you remember? He was doing his Nazis then, so you know what's not either. But it was called what? Legislation made simple. Now, in that case, I went, William Hoffman told me, you know, this is not on. So I gave up. So in short, Sandy's right, but unfortunately we can't do something about that. But she implicitly argues, right? Except you can't just do it. Okay, the subject, but I can use the word subject, there's no need for that, right? Okay, then there's some other clumsy formulations, but I'll just leave it up here. At this stage, I think I'll move on. Can we go on to like the one that says at the bottom, who must then all the function of the Secretary to the Commission, right? That is a really long, unduly sentence, and it's distant. You know. Now, the last one that I want to ask you is to replace the minister's power to make the regulations with a power. Is that correct? At the bottom of page 3. With a power for the commission to make, not that power, to make rules regarding, should it be that power? That's at the bottom end of page 3. I think everybody read this thing since last week, therefore there's no need to belabor the point. At the bottom of page 3, of, say halfway through page 3, there's no line numbers in this text, obviously. If you look at the second to last semicolon on 8, is it not the power? So you have got the answer where we are?
Jimmy, do you suddenly have the power for the position to make rules on the function? So that's why we say 8
power. A rather than that.
A is indefinite and Z is definite. So if we deal with the definite power, I mean there's other ways of dealing with this on site as well, but to make regulations with the power of the commission to make rules regarding its function. If you want to be specific, you use that. And if you're referring to the specific part to make rules, one can use that. At the moment there's nothing, I agree with something. But
so A is fine.
A is fine, but it's more correct.
Sorry?
I think that would be more correct.
That's what I think.
A power is bigger.
Well, A power is bigger.
It is
a new. No, it's a non-specific indicator. The indefinite particle.
Okay, can I ask you finally, is your view A or that? Or does it not matter?
It doesn't matter.
All right, now this A is fine. Because A, I don't like it, but hey, who can? Because now also the cost of the world, thank you. I would say use A, but fine, I won't die in this. Right, one A, right? Now I take it that since we have inserted new clauses, the officials have checked, because this morning I just felt, my God, I can't do all of this, right? So I gave up on this cross-referencing. In any case, the SDOP can catch it up, right, if it's wrong. So 19 sub 1, we make 19 sub 1 under Chief Executive Officer definition. You object, advocate, that's fine. Okay. Because remember we add some amendments. But then we go to, I noticed in the original book, you don't have under page 4, sub E there. You don't have the this act there in the original book. Well, how do you call the same who section is?
See, we just discussed this in the committee. Our indicated resolution is proposing the regulation is called this act definition of first regulation. There's no longer provision for regulation.
Okay, fine. I withdraw what I read. Then the next one, any questions? Clause 2, on page 4, sub A, sub B, sub C. Sub D on page 5, E, F, no comment. E, and then it's sub D, right? Right. Section 3, clause 3, on the bottom of page 5. Any questions there? Clause 4 on page 6. Now this is the one the committee introduced, right? It says the president must make an appointment to fill the vacancy within 6 months, right? That was our amendment. Clause 5 is as it is. Clause 6 is as it is. No, clause 6, you refer to something that's new here, the appointment basis of the chair for the full time, that was the proposal introduced by the committee, right? Okay, now sub 3, The section 5 you're referring to at the bottom of page 6, aren't you? He's referring to section 5 of the Principal Act. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Then move to page 7, colleagues' comments. This is new. A person may not hold office as a member of the commission for more than 10 months. I just find it in the original bill. So you moved it here?
It was there.
I couldn't find it. Just the suffix number changed. It was 8.3 and now it's 8.4. Oh, right. And then you got the new 8.5, right? Compared to the original bill.
Yes,
8.2
is the link
that you're seeing. So that means that changed the sequence, right?
Yes.
Good? Okay, I sort of didn't care. Now, when you look at 7, section 7, colleagues, if you look at A, 1A, right, and then you've got B, 6.1B. Now, under that, this is different again from the B1, though, right? The sub A, B, C, D that you've removed onto F, the following page. Is that correct? If you look at the original bill, it's not there. I couldn't find it. Okay, let's go to 7, right? On the original bill, it's on page 4. You're altering section 9 of the Act, right? Now, show me my friend. Where is it?
Okay.
I can't find it. Sorry, can
you? You see, when I talk about the refrain, I was thinking exactly about this. If a particular section has changed, and there's a new insertion that was under a particular section, but in the bill, it does not refer to that.
Manage the load. Remember, we have one out of
How many senses? 25?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think clearly that it's human. And I had a meeting with the staff on our side, and they sort of Bridget is on leave. So, which I was raised, by the way, we're going to have problems about voting on the reports on the department budget and on Stats South Africa, which is tomorrow. I don't know when they're going to be able to vote on this budget. Because next week also there are complications. But we'll come back to that. This parliamentary program has changed, obviously, because we asked for it to be changed. But can we agree now that all of us can agree on dispensing with that? Right? So let's go to the next one. That's on page 8 of the V1B version. I noticed you changed the format. It's not a major thing. You put under sub B on page 8, by the subsection 2, then under subsection B, but by the addition of the following subsection, they are not in the original book, right? But that's a formatting, clarifying, simplifying mechanism, right?
And Peter, in the original book, you replace the whole provision.
And then finally we repeal, this is not in the V1 version, the next one, clause 8, right? Section 12, the principle act is hereby repealed. I can't find that in the V1 version.
It's also one of the mentions we discussed in one of the meetings.
Okay, then the next one is section 9. Section 14 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the... That's not the B1 for a similar reason, right? Is that right?
Yes,
that's right.
Okay. This one deals with the sharing of interest.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. Fine. And then the next one is now here. This is weird. You see, what I'm clear about is not the role of the ordinary member in the committee either to check and cross check, right? It's really the chair's responsibility. That's why I'm moving so fast, because it's not about policy. Yeah. So what I'm trying to say is that moving fast A because we've got ministers here to go. B, but also because it's not above the ordinary member. The ordinary member deals with the policy and the context, the job of the staff in Parliament, National Treasury in this case, and myself as the chair to check these things. So I don't have any problem with members being slightly out of the loop because it's not about content, colleagues. It's about the chair's job is to oversee that this is correctly done. Now, this is not a policy issue, so I'm alerting members. Right. This is the first view of policy issues. I mean, to clarify what we actually asked for. So I'm asking for members not to actively engage. As I understood it, we said you agree to having a full-time chairperson for the FNC in the bill, provided also we put in the need for regulation that the commission must, you said it can't be regulated, the commission must actually provide for to set out the distinct and complementary roles of the CEO and the chair. That's a policy issue. That's why I'm asking members to comment. So, colleagues, look at 10 on page 9. Now we go slowly, right? Because this is now not a technical thing of getting cross-reference and things like this. This is a policy issue. 10 sub B, right? Section sub C. So, 10 B C. Right, colleagues? It's in the middle of page 9 now. Colleagues, are we all there?
Yes.
Right, because this one is a policy issue. So, here, it says, make rules regarding the effective corporate governance of the commission, which was there in the first place. And then what the committee wants is the relationship between the chairperson of the commission and the CEO. The question I want to ask, comrades, is it not that we want more than just the relationship we set up, but something like the distinct roles of and the relationship between? Shouldn't we add those words, the distinct roles of and the relationship between? That is first, let's ask the members now, the first policy issue we're dealing with, what do comrades and colleagues feel? Because if you say, let me put it to you, I won't die in a ditch about this, if members don't agree with me, it's fine, it's not an ANC policy issue. I'm simply saying, sorry? I can't hear you on the phone.
What happened
with that? We can't hear you on the phone. You're speaking into the mic, I'm afraid. What is the way we can go?
In the
deep. I can't hear.
Continue.
I'm reading now. Oh, okay. Okay. The question really is, what do we feel about it. It's not just setting out regulations, but there's a relationship, not even state, there's a relationship between the CEO and the shepherd. It shouldn't be the regulation setting out the state roles of and the relationship between. Are we agreeing with that?
Yeah.
David?
It's important to highlight the state role, because that's exactly how from the day we feel that we have a state in this position, and we don't want the another full-time person. And also the possibility of conflict between the chairperson of the commission and the CEO. Therefore, the distinct roles of both these gentlemen would be very important to see what is the
the distinct and complementary roles of and the relationship. I want to be complementary because, hey, you know what? You might have a relationship that looks clumsy.
So I would be, not the office clause in the long title. So it does include that reading as well. It's towards the end.
You can have it. No, I'm even quite good at picking it up. I'm not teasing you. Yeah, please do. Right, then, I would have given it Auntie, but I won't argue on this. Put that sub C below, but leave it look more appropriate there. But I find it's not the end of the world, running out of time. Now, insertion of section 18A, that will be clause 11. Conduct of members, 18.1. Yeah, I don't think there's any problems there. The remaining at what, right? So that one we've agreed on. Clause 12, I just want to see that under 1A, on the top of page 11, I think, you've got 1B. It wasn't in the B1 business as well, eh?
Yes, this is one comment from the FHC, because the drafting strategy
is very important. They
asked for it, yeah.
They asked for it and we agreed. That's right. That was a policy issue on which we agreed after the FSC made submissions to us, right? Okay. Then we go to, for the rest of his colleagues, it's more, it's exactly from what I could tell this morning, exactly as it was. We turn to page 12, for 13. Any comments? That's exactly what it was. Clause 14, exactly what it was. Clause 15, what it was. Clause 16. Clause 17. Clause 18. Now, clause 19, you know, I think I've seen too much of even the chair of a committee, quite frankly, to check that all the schedules are correct. I mean, really, I gave up here. And so I take it as a Jenkins speaker on behalf of Parliament, you check, Alan, that the schedules are all right. And then on clause 20, you drop the word personnel, right? And as a last, it is the 20C sub 19, the very last one there, executive officer and other staff personnel, the personnel was redundant, right? Is that correct? Okay. So one thing I'll miss this, by the way, let's go back to the beginning of the policy issue. Can we go back to page 9, colleagues? Clause 10, look at B. Right? It says by the delegation of the word and at the end of paragraph A, substitution for the expression. You've got two semicolons, you've got two semicolons, and you've got a dot in between. Presumably, the first semicolon and the dot must be moved, right? Is that right, Advocate Jacob? It's a mistake, how graphical. Right?
Well, we're adding
that. That's right.
So that goes on.
It's typographical. Good. So, if we read that there was an... I think we can put on a dot, as Tandy suggests. Because the only thing we have to do is the interjection that shouldn't have been there in the first place, right? Which is the one that is on page 7, clause 7, after the A, after B, all that is bold in the current budget, right? I mean, the same page, on B, evident, this is good. So, we can vote on the vote. But before we do, let's go to the report. Where's the report? You remember, I was asked to draft some things, so here it is. Remember this bill is long overdue, right? All of us feel. I think this one explained, it would be funny that it's taken us so long to sort out this issue of the same person being the CEO and the therapist. Mind-boggling read. But all right, we encourage you, we say, the committee welcomes itself, rather than you be puddled and bemused and bamboozled and No. I'd like to say all the back, but I'm not, because it's, you know, freedom day and all that, and we can't, like, be too tough. The committee welcomes the bill, believing that it is long overdue. That's a diplomatic version of what I'm thinking about. Major issue that the committee has to deal with is, and it's all before you write the text, should the bill include a clause that the chairperson of MSC be full-time? After careful deliberation, the committee decided for a variety of reasons that it should. Now, I'm not going to put the reasons down because it's in the minutes of all the meetings and the recordings. Otherwise, we'll spend pages on it. However, the committee also raised the following issues in this regard. One, the commission needs to clearly define the respective and complementary roles of the chairperson and the CEO of FSC. Two, given the constraints of the national budget, I hope it is impressed. FSC needs to be prudent in managing the cost of the office of a full-time chairperson. The committee will monitor this periodically. Three. Yeah. The committee will also periodically monitor the performance of the FSC chairperson. Four. There needs to be, as the committee observed in 2014 report on the department's budget, a review of the role of the FSC, taking into account experiences since its establishment and development since then. Government, Parliament, the FSC, civil society stakeholders, experts, and others need to review the role of the FSC over time. Paragraph 4 is basically literally the words from our budget report. So is this a reasonably accurate description of what we want in our report? Good. Right, so then we are ready to vote on the bill formally. So let's start with the B1B. Right. The amendments as amended, and then clause 1 as amended, clause 2 as amended, particularly in seconding, I take it clearly. Right. Clause 3, move a second up. No second up. Wait. Okay. Clause 4, I'm just so boring. Frankly, this is archaic, right? Old. Yeah. Clause 5, this is what I'm going to do. I think it is. Can't we just vote on the bill as a whole? Or do we have to go through each clause as amended?
You can vote on the bill as a whole.
To change it and you'll take your wood. Okay, so it's now no more compulsion for committees to do each clause as amended. Okay, so can we vote on the bill as a whole then? Second, right? Then, can we vote on the report as presented? Again? So,
Also, you must remember that we've got a huge load.
impossible. We can't manage it at the moment. And quite frankly, can you raise the gently with the minister? That I think we should agree with Parliament. Because, for example, we now have to take on SAA. I've got a call from the Speaker's office on Thursday, right? To say, look, the Public Enterprise Committee, I think, is trying to plan for this. Presumably, SAA falls firmly within your fault, and that, therefore, we have to have oversight on it, right? And we've agreed to make it before the committee. Now, I take it that it proves also while we're all here. But if Andy has explained that she has a family matter to attend to, so she will exit when she feels the need to. And I understand that it includes the South African Express and,
It includes Madam Moshe, but the peculiarity that South African Express not yet. We suspect that in the longer term, they will have to be combined because the current version of the long-term turnaround strategy envisions that there will be one holding company and they will fall under, now they can't fall under one holding company and the other different shareholder ministry.
Alright, if I recall correctly, colleague members, we agreed last year that while it is for the executive to decide on this matter, the committee's view is that this institution should fall under the presidency. So that remains our view. And I think that should be finalized. And the debate should really occur. I think if the presidency, the minister in the presidency falls under the portfolio committee of public service. So I think they should deal with it. Yeah. Alright, thank you very much. Over then to you.
And thank you very much for the opportunity to walk you through the founding document of the BRICS Development Bank. I'll probably refer to it later on as the New Development Bank, as well as the founding document on the contingent reserve arrangement. Now, what honorable members might notice is that there is only an explanatory memorandum in the text that you received on the contingent reserve arrangement. Shall I explain both? And hopefully you will get copies if you don't have them, and they will serve as an addendum to the original document. It was in, you will have copies, I hope, because the system is not helping us.
So, if I can clarify something, those of our comrades and colleagues who came in to assist us to vote, you are free to leave when you want, obviously, right? But if you want to stay, you're more than welcome. As long as you understand it's not that's fine. They're right, but as long as they know, they don't care because of the motion. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for our chair. I'm now on slide 3, which will talk the number, titled Initial Agreement to Establish BRICS Initiatives. It was in March 2013 that the leaders of the BRICS bank, as the BRICS country, that's the president, had received a report from the finance minister, and after receiving that report on both the new development bank and the contingent reserve arrangement, both of which I shall explain in great detail later on, they made an announcement about their satisfaction on the progress that had been made, but they also then said they thought that it was feasible that collectively they could take both initiatives forward, and they expected a briefing in September thereafter. Then in 2014, on the occasion of the annual summit of the BRICS countries, last year it was held in Fortaleza in Brazil, the founding document for the two initiatives were approved and signed. I wish to pause at this point, Honorable Chairman, divert a bit of the presentation and highlight a bit of an awkward thing to me here, but this document, as signed,
what they are. So each one of the five countries is expected to take them through their legislative processes for ratification. So in a way, I'm presuming, and the House might know how best to deal with that thing, that there is no scope for man, because in a way, they are in different, they are approved in different countries. China, for instance, has already ratified it, and the other four countries like final stages, just like ourselves, of ratification. Now, on the slide, that refers to the signing of agreement and the settlement of the bank. Very important fact about the bank are set out. First, that the initial authorized capital, which I shall explain later, would be $100 billion. Subscribed capital, I will also explain, would be $50 billion. And it was also agreed that the countries would have equal share, which share would amount to 5% of the shareholding of the bank, which means that the British country would remain majority shareholder of the bank. Its first president would come from India, the headquarters would be in Chennai, and of course there would be an Africa Regional Center, which would be established concurrently with the headquarters in Chennai. Now on the next slide, we deal with the motive, or you could say, the purpose of the bank. The idea of the bank is to use the resources, the savings that exist among the Greek countries to invest them towards addressing infrastructure challenges that the countries in the first instance face, but also that other member countries, as I will indicate, how they would join, would benefit from such investment. Now, on the next slide, we summarize the purpose of the bank, how the bank will operate, that it will operate with sound main principles. That's the first in the main, in terms of how it will evaluate the bankability or viability of projects, and how the risk associated with lending to those projects would be priced. The bank will also provide technical assistance for the preparation and implementation of projects that will be supported by the bank. This is an area that, in discussion with the BRICS countries, we have said should be a niche for the Africa Regional Center. Honorable members might be aware that several development finance institutions these days, the African Development Bank, for instance, in the process of setting up something called Africa 50 Fund, and the World Bank is also setting up a similar fund. So they've realized that one of the reasons why, despite the fact that there is a huge gap between the resources that are available in the system financing infrastructure, there is often no uptake from the limited resources that are available, because countries tend to struggle to develop projects that are bankable, projects that people can put money behind because they are convinced they would work. So the idea is that this bank would have to play a very critical role in assisting countries in this regard, and especially the center that will be in Africa, situated in Johannesburg. So the bank will provide support in the form of loans, guarantees. I may even add and other credit enhancement facilities, equity participation, and of course other financial instruments to both the public, both public and private projects in member countries. Of course, as it happens with this kind of institutions, there will be a board of governors which may approve then operations in non-member countries under predetermined conditions. Now, we get into the next set of slides, we explain several of the features of this plan. I will go through this in detail, but without really getting to bore you by explaining them, because they are simple. So we've got the founding document, which combines of the documents that are listed under 1.1. The membership with the BRICS countries, and to avoid the situation where
the baseline of a country would be lobbied by other countries with, for a greater provision should be that when countries are members of the United Nations, which then means they meet several criteria, and of course if they, for any reason, are defined in a way that excludes them from the United Nations, then this country wouldn't want to deal with such a country. So it was found very convenient to say, if countries are member countries of the United Nations, then they can become members. Now the authorized trade, which is 3-1, it's $100 billion. That nearly turns out the maximum size of capital that this bank can ever be. Of course, I indicated earlier on, it can be changed by agreement from the Board of Governors. The subscribed capital is $50 billion has been allocated to the members, and of course it will have two parts. It will have the paid-in part of $10 billion, and logically then, if members are going to have equal shares, it means that each member will have to contribute $2 billion of the $10 billion, which is the paid-in capital. Then the other part is the callable part. The example I usually use to explain this, so that people don't get scared that we now have a liability of $50 billion out there in South Africa, is that the BBSA, when it was founded, government paid in a capital of 200 million rand. And on the back of that 200 million rand, the BBSA was able to build an asset base of close to 40 million rand. Because that's 200 million, and then a quality capital of 4.8 billion. And the collateral capital was never called. Of course, recently, when the financial conditions became very bad and the bank suffered losses from some of its investments, then government had to inject some capital, which our parliament approved. But outside of that, it was possible for the bank to build a very huge asset base. So in a way, this is how the institutions work. If the initial paid-in capital is used wisely and grows, then the institution can borrow and grow its asset base without calling on the capital. But of course, under certain circumstances, calls do get made on capital, as it happens, for instance, with institutions like the IMF recently. We talked about the review of the capital at the bottom and the type of specific shareholding. I've already touched on that. Then the governance, there would be a board of governance. Now, as it happens with most institutions, and this one is not going to be different, the board of governance is usually the ministers of finance of the respective countries that are owners of the institution. So the minister of finance, just the ratio of being appointed as minister of finance, immediately became the governor of South Africa on the board of the World Bank, and similarly the IMF, and then I am alternate on the World Bank, and then on the IMF, the governor of the Central Bank is the alternate. We talked to the voting issue, and of course the decision-making processes, that major policy decision would be by consensus among the board of governors. Next slide. There will be a special fund. Now this is a fund separate from the resources, the capital of the bank, just to enable the bank to start, cover the cost at the start, cover the cost of its building, paying of the staff, best project development, costs and stuff like those. So there was an argument to set it up, and China made the offer to be the largest contributor to this. And of course, as countries ratify the treaty establishing this bank, they will be able to contribute according to their law and their ability to contribute. The points under two are known, and then of course, also three, I would say. Then the next slide. Let's then talk about the contingent reserve arrangement, which members didn't quite appear as long. Now, from time to time, countries developed and developing, but more developing, would experience balance of payment problems. they would experience shortages of foreign currency to be able to pay for imports and also to be able to pay their foreign currency commitments that they hold to. Whether those foreign currency commitments represent servicing of debt that maturing, or they represent payments, for instance, our missions abroad. They spend in dollars everywhere. So when a country that has a balance of payment problem, as it happened, by the way, with one of the big members in the Athens in 2013, then countries will need this kind of support, where some other country or a financial institution like the IMF would have to assist them with that foreign currency. It happened a lot that countries, through their central banks, would enter into something called bilateral swap lines, and I will explain this later on, and I hope that I will show it very well. But the basic concept is not very difficult. It's about being able to borrow from someone foreign currency at a pre-agreed price when you need it, and agree also how you will settle at a future date. So that then covers the first slide, so to speak. Now, what the International Monetary Fund would do for member countries, which members are familiar with, is to conduct surveillance, which is in the form of this Article 4, which are heard of. They come here, they interact with different people, they make an assessment of the country's situation, growth prospects, budget, management, and so on and so forth. They look at reserves relative to the risk or external vulnerability that the country faces, and they make an assessment. Now, usually, they use that as a starting point for determining whether a country requires support. And of course, the amount of support is usually, balance of payment support is usually connected to the size of the country's GDP and the size of the country's contribution to the IMF. So the IMF provides, but of course, sometimes its own capacity, as we met during the global financial crisis, is not limitless. That's why they had to request member countries to help them outside of the formal kind of resourcing of the IMF. We set out then on the next slide some of the reasons why it makes sense to have a facility like this. Because the conditionality that goes with the IMF resources is sometimes perceived or actually pondered. The speed with which the money can be made available, it can be long, such that by the time the money becomes available, the country may be in bigger trouble and they have defaulted. So countries then tend to form this or enter into this bilateral swap line or form these virtual pools of reserves so that they can have insurance. By the way, sometimes not having that insurance is good enough to take away the perception of vulnerability from possible speculators or current speculators, and they help it because they know that a country has got this backing from whether the IMF or this kind of independent reserve arrangement, and therefore they help it to take chances with shorting its currency. As we point out on the next slide, this is a virtual pool of foreign reserves. So in other words, we are not going to take South Africa now invested reserves in several countries outside. Someone once asked me, why don't we invest this money here? I said, look, the problem we have is that in South Africa you can only do things in rand. The irony of this kind of money is that when you want to have reserves in dollars, then you must invest them where dollars are largely used. Similarly, you want to have reserves in euros because you trade as if it's the case in our case. They've got to keep those in euros, not in a place where you use rand. So the reserves will stay where they are, invested in the way that we always invest them. However, in the way we manage them in finance,
this amount of 2 billion must already be available, the amount that we contribute to, which is 5 billion, sorry, must always be available, so that in the event that one of the countries were to need help, in which case our commitment or undertaking to help on this maximum of $5 billion, then we'll be able to draw the money from that and put it into this arrangement. Now, on the next slide, we try in a rather simple way, if not simplistic way, to explain how this would work. And I've already tried earlier. Here we present an example where, say, South Africa were to try and test this contingent reserve arrangement to the tune of $3 billion. Either way, you enter into the first transaction, which is on that date, and of course, logically, the rate that you use, the rand dollar exchange that you use, is the spot one, which is, in this example that we use, of a dollar equal to 10 rand. And of course, at the same time, on that same date, you agree forward, as they would say, the FX dealers. You enter into an agreement as to how you would unwind the transaction, how you would settle each other at the future date. And therefore you agree on what the exchange rate on that day would be. And the forward leg we use in this case is offered a dollar costing 10.25 cents. So in a way, from that, you can agree how you would settle or pay each other at a future date, and of course the would-be college creditor, for simplicity's sake, would know upfront how much they would make. Of course, the beauty of this arrangement is that if at the future date the rand would have depreciated against the dollar, in South Africa's case, the liability is calculated on the forward rate that agreed on day one. But it's a very beautiful way to present it, because in that case it looks like South Africa pays a cheaper rate than the one that would be prevailing on the day. It is also possible that when you get to that case, the South African currency against the dollar may have appreciated, in which case the security of knowing your liability upfront costs you, because you would have to buy dollars at the higher rate to settle the debt in relation to those dollars. But that's how life works. Now,
what is this all about? Let's not discuss it.
Now, in terms of, on the next slide, in terms of the size of this, it looks like there's a net with 100 billion. It's 100 billion US dollars. The individual commitment are set out there. China makes the biggest one, 41 billion. The other three countries, equal amount, and South Africa is 5 billion US dollars. I may happen to say, when you then look at the left next slide, which is the drawing limit, you then see that South Africa stands to benefit the most out of this arrangement. Because once you apply the relevant multiplier, which is 2 in the case of South Africa, in the event of South Africa were to be in trouble and need this kind of insurance or drawdown against insurance, the maximum that we could get is 2 times what we are calling liable to contribute in the event that a country or another country to need this support. What's very important, honorable members, to emphasize here is that this wouldn't be a donation to the other country. In other words, what this would represent is that if we were investing our money in sort of financial instruments in country A, which may not be one of the BRICS member countries now, as is the case, facing all the risks, by the way, associated with keeping the dollar there, we would just take those dollars, they are still ours, and we now put them in one of the BRICS member countries that needs that help. The money is still ours. When we account for all the reserves, we will still reflect whatever amount, let's say, we will still account for it as our assets. Growing interest as we do currently, wherever we invest in. Now, the current arrangement is going to be a two-tier system. There will be a council of CRA governance at the level of ministers or governors or their equivalent, and then there will be a kind of standing committee which is more operational on the matter. Then we talk to the issue of voting and how the other decisions will be taken. The last bullet on this table talks to the IMF link. Now, up to 30% of the amount, in other words, of the amount that the country is entitled to, can be drawn without a country entering into an IMF program. But because the IMF program has got real merit, it does an assessment of quality, the credit worthiness for the country and puts requirements in terms of what a particular country that goes down on the facility has got to do to make sure that it improves its credit worthiness. It was felt wise to link the remainder of the resources to the IMF staff, as I indicated, which normally uses the one to pass as the Article 4 staff. On financial implications, I've indicated on the NDB, the total amount that will be liable for immediately is 2 billion. That 2 billion is payable in 7 installments. Amount to 150 million, the first one, 250 million, second one, the third and fourth and fifth one would be 300 million, and the last two would be 350 million. You can, I mean, of course, the conversion would be done on the date the money is payable. Of course, now that we know it, we can already acquire the dollars and then be ready to pay, because that kind of an insurance that you can buy. So it will be paid in those installments. Of course, the money would be appropriated by Parliament as it usually happens. On the contingent reserve arrangement, as I said, there is no transfer of money until such time that an affected member country makes a call, and in which case the processes that have been agreed, which happen to the central bank, will trigger, and then money will go. And of course, as I was indicating, let me repeat for effect, the money will still belong to South Africa. It will still earn interest. It will just represent a different debt at the other end, as opposed to the current one. Thank you very much.
Okay, then, comments, questions? Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I think we really welcome the presentation by National Treasury on the steps that are now starting to be practical from the South African side in making sure that the British bank become established. But maybe just a few things. One will also be on the financial implications. I only see the 2 billion rand issue that has been outlined, not 2 billion US dollars that has been outlined. But I saw in one of the slides where you were also talking about a South African vision, for lack of a better way, South African vision established concurrency. I saw something around that. I can't remember which slide, but a headquarters of some kind being established in South Africa. And I'm not sure whether that also has financial implications on its own, and whether that is also taken care of by this plan. The second issue came,
I think it would be interesting to see how the three banks will be operating, whether distinctly or in a complementary way. The DBSA came in, and when we are in there, we said it is also going to Africa because of the capacity and other things. I think we have agreed as a standing committee at some point that because of the capacity and how they were able to confidently raise their capacity and their performance, they can now spread into Africa. You also have the African Development Bank that's also there, and now you have the BRICS Bank. But I also, depending on what the DG was saying, I think he has outlined some stringent measures that will make any particular country to qualify to access some of this money. But also, the biggest challenge that has been member states not being able to bring projects to bankability. So, and one welcome that. Probably that approach may even assist the DBSA maybe to learn from yourself, because there have been projects where we want, linking, I will use that as an example, and I know I'm out of order here, but just a practical example, where you have code in Botswana and code in South Africa and Lephalale, and where you want to have a railway line that links Mamabuja in Botswana and Lephalale into, you know, that coal haulage. It has been something that the DBSA wanted to see happen, and it couldn't take off precisely because of whether visibility up to bankability has been a problem or what. So I really welcome the approach that the DG has outlined in assisting member states to be able to access the money. And I think this is an approach that DG, on the hindsight, you may want the DBSA to learn from and improve on some of the things that they are doing. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. And obviously, I think we recognize that there isn't much that we can do in respect of what is happening, but just to assist one to understand, all the nitty-gritties about the BRICS bank. What I wanted to know is that what is the current, or whether there has been a dividend policy adopted, and how is it going to work? And in percentages, what is South Africa's equity in that? And if we look at that, you've spoken about the benefits that we will have as South Africa, but one is also not, we shouldn't be naive about the current situation of South Africa, and also even some of the hostilities that one is beginning to observe. Now, if we are saying we are going to, we are also, I don't know whether it's my own impression, but it appears as though we are not going to be differing that much from the IMF in terms of our living criteria. But at the same time, I'm also cautious about saying that because I'm not sure what is going to be the implications of those countries that are already probably in bad books with IMF, and probably most of them here in Africa and within South Africa wouldn't probably further make South Africa, other countries be more hostile towards South Africa. To what extent are we integrating the processes of BRICS, of the establishment of BRICS Bank, and strengthening our own South African international relations policy, especially when it comes to how we handle issues in Africa?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. When is it going to launch the bank formally? And when will it
actually happen that the center will be launched if there's any dates at the time. And as we check in, I know you've got enough on your shoulders, right? But what I'd also like to know is whether it's legal for a member to expropriate, I know that corporation burned off, and the entire hot water that's here for her desk to serve herself tea and coffee, while others have to negotiate now with her because she and her colleagues next to her have decided to produce. Do you think the rules are in Parliament can do a paper? I'd like to apply them and do a report and come back in. How much do we need? How much do we need Parliament to require here? Come back to us this time next year with an input. Thank you.
The question on the cost of establishing the Africa is a quite an apt one. There will be costs. The idea is to try right at the outset to ensure that almost all costs associated with them are on this books. That this may not happen to the T right from the beginning. There may be a price to be paid by China for instance, having the headquarters in China. And then, just to illustrate, they have showed us a temporary location with the bank. They have showed us the site where the permanent one will be built. And as you can see, they are doing things, certainly on the temporary one, but we have not yet paid for Washington or any other country. So, in a way, just in the spirit of togetherness and kind of social solidarity, there will be costs that individual countries are prepared to incur in the beginning just to make sure that the thing gets started. But at the same time, the special fund that I referred to earlier is meant to be actually a mechanism through which such initial costs will be covered. So in our case, we interacted very constructively with one of the municipalities, and they have signaled to us possible funds for the temporary accommodation as well as the permanent accommodation. I'm almost certain that when it comes to the permanent accommodation, there will almost be no cost to South Africa, like as an individual country, but as a member contributing its share. It's likely that we will pay. But in so far as the temporary one, just to get it started, there may be some reasonable cost to incur, which we don't expect to be too much, because the given that the institution has got to start functioning very soon, and I'll come to that question that the chairperson there will be some kind of minimal cost. It will be, for instance, an existing structure already. The kitting might be some renovation, partitioning, and it's not meant to have too many people, even maybe 10 or so. So the cost associated with that would be minimal. Now, members have asked what I consider to be a fair question, by what distinguish this bank from the other that exist. One of the points of emphasis among the leaders and the ministers of finance is that this institution complements the other institutions that exist. That straight away, it's not about this one is going to be very different affair. But there will be differences. There will be differences. There is no question about the fact that the government arrangement, that the broader government arrangement, if members have been following, for instance, the debate, certainly if you think about the IMF, which is not quite a bank of the kind like this one, the government stuff there has been on hold since 2010. And just the balance of power is such that moving on certain things can take so many years, because the arrangement is such that you have got individual countries are so big as shareholders, they end themselves the right at the time institutions were established to veto the the decisions of the collective that such will not prevail. If you think about the equal share, immediately puts people on an equal footing. regardless of their size and sample. That's a very important distinction in light of what I've just said about the existing distribution. But similarly, there are things that are almost not fragile, but I dare not get into the details because I could have chosen otherwise, but there's sometimes total lack of sensitivity to the developmental challenges that developing nations face. So that in the bigger multilateral institutions, sometimes the priorities are in conflict with the needs and the stage of development that the developing countries are at. Here you have got life by and large, and therefore the priorities would be set in a way that responds almost directly, sympathetically to the immediate challenges of developing countries. But of course, this will be a ban, hence the emphasis that it will be run like any other ban. Now let me explain why that becomes exceedingly important. One of the things that are critical to be able to achieve this goal of injecting a little bit of capital, not maybe a little bit, is a bit of a silly, inappropriate thing, to inject $10 billion in paid-in capital, and expect that would actually grow over time. If you want to achieve that, you can only achieve it if you first achieve an A credit rating for the bank. Right? Possibly you would want A in the long term, that it should be AAA, the highest achievable credit rating. Because if you are able to do that, then you can raise capital cheaply and be able to pass on the benefit of a lower weighted cost of capital to the borrowers who are likely to develop in countries. Now to achieve that, not only do the rating agencies look at the support that the bank receives from member countries, in other words, how quickly do member countries make their contributions when they are called to do so, and what creditor status do they give to the bank, in other words, when they have difficulties meeting their commitment, do they prioritize the bank and so on. But they also look at your loan book. What is the percentage of your non-performing loans? Now, sure, the percentage of your non-performing loans is some function of how tight your lending criteria are. If you lend to countries whose probability to default is very high, then chances are that they will default and their non-performing loan will be used as a proportion of your total loan. And in that case, you will be jeopardizing your ability to get a good credit rating. So those things come into the equation. I mean, on the side, I often say this, and there is a realization amongst almost all institutions. Of course, the competitive edge and the little bit of jealousy will always be. If you think about the African continent, I can't estimate the infrastructure deficit in dollar terms amounts to just under 100 billion per annum. No institution exists to be able to meet this, assuming the capacity to resolve the project into bankable, you know, project stage existence. We wouldn't be able to meet it. So the scope for all institutions to commit sometimes, work together at times, to finance infrastructure development here and abroad. And I'm referring here to the point about the DPSA. I mean, the DPSA is interestingly, and the AFCB, and certainly, by the way, even the World Bank, they have been in discussion about cooperating, even in South Africa, you know, to support certain projects. So there is scope for everyone to play. On dividends, the idea with these banks, is never to take money out. But if there were to be money taken out, with, you know, let's say now the bank has grown 10 years time, and it was all members, South Africa would be entitled to
if one share of the 55% of the total land, let me take a step back and say, before Adam and Eve joined, South Africa would be entitled to its 20%. Right? If it were hypothetically going to be a dividend. If then Adam and Eve joined, in this case, the British member would retain the 55% share, then they would share equally the 55%. But the idea with this kind of thing is to recycle the money for development, for as we need it to. Now the financial cost, it's a very important point. The immediate, once we start, which we estimate, we suspect that by the next budget, to be safe, we will probably have to put, if not as a budget request through the normal process, we would have to have it under provision at the very least. But the immediate one would be 1.5 billion rand, roughly, if you use today's exchange rate. Because it's 150 million US dollars. Then you have to already have the 250, then it gets to 300 US dollars for the equivalent in rand would translate accordingly. Now, let me explain the concept of authorized capital subscribed briefly. The authorized capital is just a notional maximum size that the bank can be from the capital contribution. Then the supplied capital is the capital that may have to be contributed over some time or course, which is now half of that, which is 50 billion US dollars. Then there is the paid-in and collectible. The paid-in and collectible are part of this 50, which is supplied. The paid-in is what you have to put in this case, in 7 installments, to make up the 10 billion US dollars, where each one of the 5 countries would have contributed is 2 billion shares. So then the 40 billion becomes the callable part. Now that's where then I was making that example of the DBS, that the paid in there, if you would use the notion, was 200 million, the callable was 4.8. In other words, it's a promise, which is a very good thing, that when the bank calls, and all it takes is a vote by the executive board, right, to say we need more capital and it should be this much, then paid over this time and then there's a call and then make the payment. A party of the respective country make the payment. Now, the link to the IMF. By the way, just in passing, I mean, there is a state, on the CRA, there is a portion that's not linked at all. Uniquely, IMF people tend to think that it's a development bank. Not quite. I mean, it's a World Bank, which is, the CRA more represents what the IMF does in this arrangement. And the NDP represents more what the World Bank does. Lending for development, or the IDRC, so to speak. Now, it's a very interesting point raised by two honorable members about whether connecting the facilities here could work or mitigate against our own sort of strategy and foreign relations and stuff like that. The interesting thing, honorable members, on this, when we were on a few occasions, when countries have approached South Africa to help them, it would be sometimes after the country has struggled to raise money from some other sources. Let me not mention who they may be. When you go to the document for the conditions that the other sources of funding require, you look at the requirements that they set for the would-be borrower, you realize that if you were to say, let's push aside those requirements, that South Africa will want to help you, we wouldn't do so without looking strange. Because in essence, It's about the difference between whether you're getting a car or a loan. Like, if you are a shop, just take the example of a shop and you're going to give credit, right? Almost all shops would ask for a fake name. They just want to understand, you know, do you have the most card that you can pay? Because you've got an income. I mean, they lend to students, I don't know how. But let's say, in normal world. So in a way, I'm just saying, almost using a rather trivial example, to say, most of the conditions that the institutions impose are friendly. The differences then are in the nuances. Do you want to prescribe, say, in fine detail, macroeconomic policy to another country? You know, it's those kinds of nuances. Or do you take that as a given? A lot of strange things that you know are important in ensuring that you can play. Sometimes the differentiation is not as easy as one makes in theory. I mean, there was an argument that the United States of America can be left out, but later on there might be considerations to bring it in. The interest payment, I would expect it to vary. Some of these things are yet to be determined by the people who are going to be employed from the second half of this year. In fact, late first half and second half of this year, then they will settle things. There cannot be one interest rate because the risk profile of different countries will differ, or it may even different projects in a country. I mean, you can even think about our own state-owned companies, which would qualify for borrowing from here. You know, you move from one to the next, they are chalk and fee. So the interest rate that would be charged from each one would differ. I've sort of, in an indirect way, touched on the structural adjustment related very soon the conditions type stuff. The deadline is asking a very important question. The formal launch of opening of the doors and stuff is likely to be around the summit. BRICS summit in July, which is in Russia. But before that, certain key appointments I suspect will have been made already. Whether announced before that date or announced at that date, I'm unsure. So, in our case, the deadline for us, it would be great if we can have this through our process by the end of May. But if it takes longer, as I say, certainly by the time we get to the summit, it would be terrible for our country to be left behind in terms of the ratification. We would also love not to be the last, but if our process would take long, so be. But it would be good if we do it. Just that there was a question about the size of
The World Bank, which is the IBRD part of the bank, the International Bank of Construction and Development, is one aspect of the World Bank that will be doing similar work with what the Greek bank will do, has an authorized capital of $280 million. The subscribed capital of the World Bank is $232 billion, of which only $14 billion of it is paid in debt. The IMF was different from the World Bank and the International Bank. It was more of local responses, not like the members of the IMF would contribute. And then the SDR, which is $476.8 billion, equivalent to about $765.7 billion.
The same you can say, I mean, you know, at the face of it, people think 100 billion is small, but I mean, you know, in time, one can make a big difference, and at the same time, we didn't want to be ridiculous. We debated how people had to be, to say something big. You don't want to say you will move the world, when in actual fact you can't move a mountain, so you've got to be realistic. But we think that it would, when fully adapted and operational, can make a difference.
What is the name of this project? New Jersey Bank. I'm sorry, I can't name it after you, Pinky. Chinese will be upset, Brazilian will be upset, Chinese will be upset. But we think about it.
So
wanted BRICS to be in it, BRICS Development Bank, but you could look when other members come in, you might put them off by, you know, they're also talking, so it's what's in the name. If a cat gets his mind, his color doesn't matter.
It's a blender.
Okay, any more questions coming?
Look, as far as the interface is, and it's doable, I don't see a problem. Because you don't see the COP as well, right?
So you want both of us to pass it before you?
The headquarters is going to be in Shanghai, that's what you said. And what should be in South Africa? What should the headquarters just be? Will it be at the African chapter that's going to be in South Africa?
We call Africa in our center. The idea, that this would be, they likely to be a footprint of this bank in key regions. First, there was the thought it can't be there, but the idea was to China and India, maybe close, maybe even Russia, but then. So it was clear then that the two places that are far from the head office, geographically, it's ourselves and within the Brazil. Now, the idea was, you want a feeling of accessibility, is the accessibility one, but the priority for the center in the beginning is going to be project development. And it's a very powerful issue. That's why I was explaining, because a lot of countries struggle, first because they don't have money, but second, they don't have the wherewithal to make a case to get money, which is this piece about the project development stuff. Where I'm saying the world has become aware of this. I expect that it's going to be a big issue at this financing for development conference later this year in Addis Ababa. It's going to be a big thing. I mean, this last paper already hinted this, because if not only do you not have money, but you don't have the ability to explain that you need it and you deserve it, then you don't have the chance. So we want to prioritize that. So it's going to be an easy accessibility to the bank for Africa. But also, not only the house, the technical expertise, or the way to get technical expertise to develop valuable projects, so that we are better placed as a country and continent to access the resources of the bank.
Thank you very much. Before we, the people would love to do a report, I'm not saying table it now, on how we manage substance agreements, so much as, you know, international protocols, double tax agreements, and so on. I have also conferred with various people, and actually been in the Mrs. Room, to change the process in any other way than the way we can think. Which makes us feel a bit impotent, because these things are bad. Because the parliament is not on the matter. But I'm sure other parliaments also do it like that. So it's something beyond our consideration. So I don't think we'll do much about it. But that has to be the table conversation, because we'll decision take and we'll implement the decision that we take. So at some stage, video, you ask to do something which is sensing your time, we need to slot that in. You can go GGA. Thank you very much. Okay, we're over then to the money on that. And the I think the PBO wants to also comment after you spoke. Is that correct, Mr. Simon? On the money?
Not necessarily, Chair, but just for any clarity. Not necessarily.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure, Alex, should have. Use the PowerPoint presentation. I have it on my. Chairperson, Honourable Member, thank you very much. I'm not going to wait for much longer. Chair, the Act came into operation 16 April 2009. We talk about the Moneyball Amendment, procedure and related matters act that follows from the obligation of Parliament under Section 77 of the Constitution to have a statute that deals with procedures to amend money books. On the 24th of May, Chairperson, Honourable Members, the National Assembly adopted a resolution to refer the book to the Standing Committee on Finance to review it and to report back to the House. And in this resolution, on the screen, it instructs the Finance Committee to review it, possibly to introduce amending legislation, and to look at three specific areas: the time frames and sequencing, the procedures to be developed in the rules, and the functioning and management of the budget office. The resolution, I chair, gives the Standing Committee the mandate to report on any matter that relates to the implementation of the Act. Initially, it requested a report by 21 September 2012, as I initially, because that had been done. There was a progress report submitted on 20 September 2012. Up to date, there was one submission received from the KwaZulu-Natal provincial legislature, and I'll refer to that later. Okay. Chair, I would like to just take the committee briefly through the areas which the resolution highlights. First one being the time frames and sequencing. And Chair, let me just at the start indicate that the time frames in the Act is hard tight, but Parliament in the meantime has become accustomed to it. I think, and the Treasury speaks for itself, even National Treasury has amended certain areas of the Division of Revenue Bill to accommodate these time frames and the fact that it's difficult to comply with the Money Bills Act as well as the part of the Division of Revenue for one decade every year. But there are various areas that the Act looks at time frames and sequencing. But for the time frames, the first area is this budgetary review and recommendation report that we all know quite well by now. The Act requires that a committee of the National Assembly must submit its budgetary review recommendation report after the adoption of the appropriation bill, but before the adoption of the report on the NCBPS. Now, a notion has developed, a few committees have raised it, so should we not finalize a report on the oversight obligations on BRRR prior to the minister introducing the NCBPS, so that the minister can take account of the NCBPS, can take account of the BRRR before the NCBPS is introduced. Now, my suggestion to the Chair is, of course, the National Treasury must actually be able to tell us what goes into the NCBPS, at what stage does it finalize it, because if we report the BRRR a week or two before the NCBPS, it's not going to do much change to the NCBPS. Chair, the other area of the NCBPS, the Act requires that Parliament reports that after the introduction of the NCBPS, reports on the NCBPS. Now that's a double jeopardy error in the Act, because we report 30 days after the introduction of the NCBPS, we should be reporting in December. In practice already, we report within the year, so that amendment is there, a minor amendment in my view. So when one looks at how Parliament can have more flexibility in the schedule, the sequencing that the Act requires is an interesting area. The Act requires both with the adjustment budget and the budget area that first the Minister introduces a fiscal framework and an adjustment budget, a revised fiscal framework or a possible revised fiscal framework, a Division of Revenue Bill, a Division of Revenue Amendment Bill in the adjustment budget process, and then of course appropriation bill, adjustment appropriation bill. Those three instruments are always there. Sometimes, or most of the time, you also get your revenue proposal with your budget. Now, the Act requires that it's only after the adoption of the fiscal framework or your revised fiscal framework that Parliament is allowed to refer the bills to the committees for consideration. And a notion has developed there, why can't we refer the bills at the same time the fiscal framework, but rather sequence the reporting? So you're not allowed to report on the Division of Revenue until we have finalized the fiscal framework. The reason for the sequencing, Chair, I think this is critical to understand, is that there must be a keyhole alignment between what is done at your macro level, the fiscal level, and then come down to your Division of Revenue Bill and then find your appropriation bill. And these should be aligned. There cannot be an appropriation which is not
envisage in the division of revenue, because we cannot have a division of revenue allocating revenue across the three tiers of government that does not is not consistent with the fiscal framework. So the drafters of the legislation thought it best that you cannot refer to rules because you need guidance in considering the rules from the fiscal framework. Should we remove that, there would be no guidance for the fiscal framework. You might have a report on the fiscal framework and 2 days later the committee wants to report on the division of revenue book, and there's really very little alignment. So it's an option there, Chair. I think Alan distributed the sort of working document track change of the money book act, which we've worked on in the last few years. Now, I've made a note on that one. I've not made amendments to that. Just a note. So there are risks, advantages and risks. 2 months later, think it was the sequence, let's sequence the reporting rather than referral. You run the risk that there's very little guidance given to committees to deal with these appropriation bill and the division of revenue bill. Yeah, the revenue bill is a very interesting area. I think anybody who was involved with the drafting of this legislation knew that when we got to the issue of revenue bill, there was a certain saturation point reached, and there's no specific procedure and time frame set up for revenue bill in the legislation. And in my discussions with the parliamentary budget office, that has come out quite strongly. We have not had proposal from legal service side. We really want to note that it's a policy decision that the committee can pay attention to. And I think the budget office might be able to help or not, but we have been in discussions and there's an area for development in the Act. The adjustment budget chair I've already spoken about. So if I can go to the next slide. The third part that relates to the resolution of the House, coordination between committees, fulfilling their mandates. Chair, please blame me for trying to pass the buck, but there's a review of rules process going on, and it's taking cognizance of what's happening here. In any event, I would say, let's review the bill, or let's review the Act, if necessary, reduce a amending bill. Deal with it before we get to the rules, because it will follow on sequence. But the review of the NA rules, which is presently under, is looking at this, and there are drafts before them. Very broad, basic rules, how committees can interact with one another when they deal with money bills, and how can a dispute between two different committees be resolved by either the Standing Committee on Finance or the Standing Committee on Appropriations or the counterparty NCO. Chair, I think one of the critical areas in the legislation is the establishment of the Parliamentary Budget Office. It is no secret, Chair, that the Parliamentary Budget Office has been established. I have been involved with many discussions with them. There are some administrative issues with the Parliamentary Budget Office. If one can summarize it, is the ability to perform and deliver on a mandate in accordance with the legislation, but without actually having the proper infrastructure, accountability lines, responsibility lines set out in the legislation. One must remember that the Financial Management of Parliament Bill was passed signed into law a few days after the Money Book Amendment Procedure Act. The Money Book Amendment Procedure Act is Bill 9 of 2009. Financial Management of Parliament is Bill 10, not Bill Act number 10 of 2009. So they can consequentially to the present and decide them consequentially. In other words, Section 15, nowhere in the Money Book Amendment Procedure Act is there an alignment with the Financial Management of Parliament Act. That is sort of the macro view on the management of the budget office. How the budget office receives money from Parliament. How does it account for that? Section 15 merely stipulates that the director must have an annual report and must be tabled in Parliament. But if one reads the Financial Management of the Parliament Act, if you look at the Public Finance Management Act, not the director or a common officer that tables documents in Parliament, it's the executive authority. So the first thing I want to put out there is there's no role for the executive authority in Section 15. In other words, as the body that's only responsible for financial management of funds, should the executive authority not play a role here? In other words, should the director not submit the report to the executive authority who is responsible for tabling these policies? That's one question. The
similar question comes with the appointment. The act as it is at the moment is the four committees, the two standing committees on finance, the two committees on finance, and the two committees on appropriations, that must basically sit together and come up with a candidate to nominate to the House. But like many other, or many institutions, not similar to the PBL, but other institutions, whether it's the SADC or ICASA or the people body for safety of sports, the question always arises, who initiates the question, where does it start, who's actually going to place an advert in the newspaper, who's taking the responsibility to say, well, we've received at this point a notice from the then director that wants to vacate the position, who initiates the new process. So there's a proposal in the, I don't want to call it a draft, but the working document that looks like a bill, to say that the executive authority should do that. The executive authority should instruct, not necessarily instruct, but initiate to say to the committee, this is your job, please go and find a candidate or consider these candidates. One of two. Remember that the act doesn't propose any changes. The appointment of the director must always be an open and transparent manner. So there's a role to play there for the executive authority. Also, when the director is absent or unable to fulfill the functions of the director, who appoints someone to act in his or her place? At this point in time, a lot of these management responsibilities rest on the four committees as such. Now, there's a suggestion we do there to say that, as what has happened in practice, they take chairpersons of those committees and the relevant house chairpersons to act in a manner to manage these areas of the vice office, whether it's the organogram, the salary scale, or the different positions within the budget office, etc., etc. The four committees, as they are sitting together or getting them together to do that function, is, I think, Chair, from my experience, it's not efficient or effective. It might even not be possible at times. Of course, people must meet, so it might be possible for someone, but it's very difficult. The reporting part I've mentioned, Chair. So, those are some of the areas that we need to look at the budget office. I think when one wants to drill down, we want to say to the parliamentary budget office, Chair, the following question is a fundamental quality question. What must the PBO be? Is it part of parliament that gets money from parliament and then accounts for that money through the executive authority to Parliament, or does it account for that money to the accounting office of Parliament? The Act, Section 15 at the moment, is deliberately drafted to say you're going to account to Parliament, not through the accounting officer of Parliament, in other words, not through the Secretary of Parliament, but straight to the House. And the purpose behind it is to have more flexibility, more effectiveness, more efficiency within the Parliamentary Budget Office. But the Act merely mentions Parliament must transfer money to the PBO. Now, transfer is due to an entity with independent legal personality. In other words, Treasury can transfer money to the DBSA. The DBSA can sue and be sued in some name. As things stand at this point in time, it's not sure whether the budget office and the director has that same independent legal personality apart from Parliament's administration. The Act can make it clear, it should make it clear, that person to say, you don't have to use the word transfer, even to say we allocate funds for these purposes to the budget office and this is how you must account, and we need to align it with the financial management of Parliament. Another option in this regard, Chairperson, is to say, let's create a totally, in this case, a fundamental policy question, let's create a PBO where you do transfer funds that can do at least through its own separate legal personality. One must just think of the costing implications, but that's another option. So the budget office actually stands alone. When we did our research before establishing the budget office, this is what they have in some countries. For instance, America has a congressional budget office that stands separate from the Congress, has its own budget, functions independently with its own legislation. We went halfway there in our section, not all the way. If we do go all the way, we must just make sure in terms of what and when the budget office must account for its private funds, because that is a constitutional relation that remains. We have to account for it. Chair, I'm just mentioning that we carry some responsibility of the director for the financial management and HR management, human resource management. In other words, is the director going to be the accounting officer of the parliamentary budget office, accounting to Parliament through the executive authority as the executive authority, or also the budget. So there are Parliament administration on one side, you have the director, the budget office, the other, and both will account to Parliament, but through the executive authority. Should there be a role for the executive authority to initiate the process of the appointment of the director? The reporting, I think you said that enough. And instead of a committee doing management functions, I think they should not just be the chairperson. One can always think that the chairperson should come back to the committee. The chairperson is fundamentally accountable to the committee who has elected them in any event. And then the issue of an acting allows to put it there that the act, and the director cannot perform the functions that he or she is supposed to. Who is going to appoint the acting director? So there are other issues in the act, and I will, when I read them to the field, reflected after the PBO issue. I think the PBO is the critical issue in the act. From where I'm sitting, from the few years I've been working with it, we need the parliamentary-based office to function the way Parliament wants it to function. That's why I mentioned the critical policy question. But there are other issues, and I would like to mention them there. Members read through the working document that the package article. Work through them, one will see the notes that we've made there. There's certain language that's used in the Act that can be improved. I've mentioned an example of within, after. Those mistakes were made at the beginning. There's new definition for executive authority, definition of NTEF, medium-term expenditure framework. That's something that's not dealt with in the Act. Certain areas of the Act speaks of performance information, and there's been a development in that area through national treasury documents. We've adopted the latest wording that we can look at in terms of performance information and how you report on them. Here there's a constitutionality issue that the act that is unconstitutional, but there is an issue in the adjustment budget, and I'm now looking at section 12.6, where it says that when we, because of time constraints, let me say that, because of time constraints, the fiscal framework which is not fit for legislation, that can be dealt with in a joint meeting. But then the Act was drafted to say there should be a joint meeting to consider the Division of Revenue Amendment. And that's the 76th legislation. So, of course, the Houses have to adopt that separately. But the impression is created that it can be a joint process. Chair, one must look at that because it cannot be a joint process to adopt the Division of Revenue Amendment. So, in practice, of course, it's not happening. The joint process is happening separate, like 76 legislation should be considered, so we can make the language a little bit clearer. Chair, the other bullet points that I've spoken to them. What issue, Chair, before I quickly summarize, is the norms and standards of provincial legislatures, which is where KwaZulu-Natal provincial legislature made submission. I think they anticipated the previous committee's work, so they made it there, and also made it at the organization we are part of called the Legal Advisors Forum, which is legislative sector legal advisors getting together to discuss issues of common interest. It's a subcommittee of SALSA, the secretary of this forum, of the secretaries of the legislature, which is again a substructure of the speakers forum. Chair, Section 183 of the Constitution, much like this with the Parliament, says the provincial legislature must have a provincial act to deal with the amendment procedure for microbes. While that is said, the issue of the treaty norms and standards is a national competence. So, somewhere in between there, if Parliament wants to provide norms and standards provinces, one cannot go beyond norms and standards in terms of the Constitution. The way that the schedule to the act is drafted at this point in time, we actually set up their own procedure for them, that they have to have certain committees that they must report in a certain manner, etc., etc. And of course, during the top of the legislature, that says that goes too far, we are breaking those boundaries set by the Constitution in terms of prescribing for provinces. Chair, I agree with most of their arguments on that one. I think we did go too far on that. So the question rather is, how do we tailor, whether we tailor a normal standards provinces, whether necessary, and if so, where's the Constitution and Minister of Parliament can be there without going into the provincial competence of legislation. So the way forward, there are hard decisions for the committee to be made. We need to agree on a process. In other words, the process could be developed and consider a draft amendment law, should that be necessary, or just a process to work through the legislation.
If there's a draft amendment bill, of course, there's public hearing, there's a report, and eventually reporting back to the House, which will then be basically introduction and adoption of the draft, but like it was with the Money Bill Act in its own time. So that's from me in a nutshell, thanks.
David?
If this committee is expected to outline the process, obviously we need to know what progress has been made, because this was raised by the National Assembly on the 24th May 2012, and we are now in 2015, and obviously there must have been a lot of work that was done. And for us to apply the process, we also have to know where is the process of action, what has been done in terms of that between the period and now, so that it becomes a lot easier for us to do that. And again, I think it makes the way forward should have been much more than what we have here, because it was possibly going to be saying, this is where we are, and this is the recommended process going forward. I'm not sure whether the committee is expected to reinvent the process that, in my view, should have been underway anyway, that we should just, our role now is really to be filling in, you know, the missing gap or leaks or whatever. I'm not sure. Maybe Architect Nation can clarify that to us, because to me, this looks like something that ought to have been done long time ago, and I would imagine that it should be at very advanced stages by now.
Thank you,
Chairperson. I think I know the time frame that was given, or the mandate, the time when the mandate was given to this committee to deal with the considerations of the amendments to this money bill. And like Congress Makosi is saying, maybe it will be very critical for us to also be given a report on how far were some of these things taken. And Chair, I want to understand it the way you raised it somewhere last year. Was it last year when we started with considering the budget immediately after we were sworn in? You remember we had a very fast time to deal with certain things. Is this amendment also trying to look at the timelines that we deal with all the reports or the assignments from when the minister table
until the time Parliament adopts, so that there's a realignment of all those things, that Parliament is not given limited time to deal with some of these things, including the public hearing. Is it an attempt to deal with that? And it will be very interesting for us to hear. Where do you think are the areas that you thought are very critical so that you can be able to look at them? In line with what Makosi was saying around progress made. On the PBO chair, I had thought the PBO is there to objectively advise not only us as a committee, but other relevant committees that fall within the parameters of the PBO. And I'm not sure whether through our legal service you have seen something that is illegal, that is to align them accordingly in terms of their reporting, or there are challenges in terms of accountability, probably AG being one of them, and so on, so that we are able to know some of these things. Yeah. Thank you.
I just spoke on something around the issue of functions and management of a PBO. I got to understand that the PBO, our PBO is working with it, is that correct? Or something. And I'm just looking at the issues that have been raised here, and I'm not sure whether we have really looked at what are the well-established PBO people, how they, you know, do in terms of the issues that are raised here, so that when we deal with this, at least we know what is the best practice, and obviously try and look at our own situation. And I'm not sure if this digital process that I'm made aware of is not assisting in terms of also assisting in strengthening the institutional arrangements of our own PBO, because it sounds like it's more to do with institutional arrangements. It's not like, you know, issues that, you know, it's even that you can learn from others.
What's the last committee say by May last year? Obviously in the 2014 period, because elections were looming, the committee didn't have that much time, but the year or so before that, you talk about the interim report. What did the interim report say? Can you have copies of that? What happened subsequent to the interim report on the 20th of September, 8th of April? In other words, we would like to pick up on where they left off. And essentially, they were more expedient in the money bills that we currently are. Secondly, we have already taken decision that chairperson from the NCOP Finance Committee, Charlotte, will be leading this process of reversal of the court. So we would like this bill to be tabled in the NCOP first. All bills seem to be tabled in the NA. But I think they must manage this bill. There's an agreement that Sean will be the key person. If I'm correct, the board of the PBO may also have sanctioned, I'm not sure that they have, that Sean will be the key coordinator. The thing is that while Parliament must decide, obviously, according to what suits Parliament, we have to take into account national treaties. When I have tended to be raised with some senior national representatives, they say basically there's very limited room for something pinky that we get squashed. And we have asked, couldn't something be done about this? And I did speak to a senior rep of the National Treasury, and he told me, look, it's going to be very hard to do. Now, that may not be altogether correct, or maybe if you saw it on the executive, but the question I want to ask you is, have you spoken to the National Treasury about the proposal? Then, as far as the PBO goes, I don't know if I speak for everybody or most of us, but it seems to me reasonable to suggest that at least some of us are thinking very highly of the PBO. And quite frankly, they have our sympathy and empathy
and we will be very sympathetic to what they have to say. So has the PBO approved of proposals who have suggested, by PBO I mean the PBO as a whole, the head of the PBO, the director, and has the board, I serve on the board, but I missed the last meeting, this is a cash flow committee meeting, I'm not sure if the board has approved of the amendments you are suggesting. Other thing I want to ask is, do we want to put every little thing in legislation or not? It's another thing we want to think of, because 2-3 years from now, might find this very committee, having passed this bill later here, suddenly realizes that it wants to change the other day. Like, you know, we often say a minister may regulate. You can't do that in this bill. But you can be some part of the PBO board. On the issue of bringing four committees together, I can only despair at that proposal. I know which planet, but I don't want to speak more than that, because the current minister has had a chair of the committee at that time. But this was just, I don't know why Pollard could ever imagine to do those things. I really think you should have exactly the board, even getting the four chairpersons together to sit at a board meeting is extremely challenging. Now, basically, look, when you are looking at the changes, you also have to look at our capacity challenge. It is very, very hard for us, given the limited capacity we have. And even if we get the best, we get another 2 or 3 prisons. You can't manage the agency. I mean, look at the superior staff and the expanded staff they have. So, we have to think about providing, as Winky said, more space for Parliament to apply its mind more fully to the budget and the adjustment appropriation. And that means, you know, we need more time. We also recognize, like our one suggestion I had was, why don't we bring, for example, the annual report a month earlier? So instead of this table by the end of September, we must table it at the end of August. I remember there were a lot of reasons given why that's difficult. We are for more than 16 weeks, considering a lot of reasons that the senior national treasury person I speak of put to me. Who should the PBO answer to? Isn't that the question you're asking? Should it be to the speaker effectively and the chairperson of the House? Or should it be to the accounting officer? But if you see the role of the PBO, for its role has to account surely to the speaker. Insofar accounting for the money is concerned, all of us are accounting for the accounting officer. So I don't know what really the issue there is, but I'm going to take on to all these questions now. I think these are things we all need to apply our minds to. The more practical question to ask you is, when do you hope to have a bill? I think your question is, should you go and report first and then bill for a whole director? I think that's too much part of it required us to which you present the report first. Part of which would be the bill. Wouldn't that be correct? We have to do what the House required us to do. What we really need to do is carry these things forward. Maybe set up a subcommittee or something to look at these issues and come back. I don't know how we do it, but we don't need to answer all the questions now. Thank you.
I've got some good news and some bad news. The good news is that on the screen now we have our interim report.
Yes.
And I will give it to Alan, who can distribute it to the colleagues. The bad news there is that unfortunately the bulk of the work on this resolution that was adopted in 2012 will have to be done by this committee or the committee that comes after this, because I know Mr. Mukumari, and I take with the greatest of respect, like his own committee chair, has been loaded with a lot of legislation from Treasury, and I think when we're listening to National Treasury, one sees that a lot of legislation is on the number of 20 coming up for a few years, and there's briefings, there's analysis, there's a normal budget process, there's more legislation that comes in, there's changes to the regulatory board. So it was very, very difficult for that committee to set aside dedicated time to actually pay attention to this. So I did a
similar presentation for them. We did a interim report on the 20th, the one on board, and that more or less where it was. So there was no, I did some presentations to the study group just to explain some of the ideas, because we had a technical team working on it, consisting of NGOP, NA, procedural officers, legal services, committee staff, etc. So we came up with a whole host of proposals which we discussed. We tried to pull them down, get the most critical ones necessary, which are not so necessary. We had some discussions with other role players, more senior officials, bounced a lot of ideas off national policy, but in terms of Parliament, the committee grabbing it and starting to work with it, that had not happened yet because of time constraints. So that is where we are. Unfortunately, that question of should we not just finalize the work that is done already? Yes, but we're going to have to do that work first, and then we should finalize it. That's the bad news. Not much has been done on this. But here we have spoken in LA with Peter. I work closely with them. I think from my side we have good relationships, but everybody has it bad day. Sometimes I have a bad day, you know. So we are working with them. The proposals in section 50, as well as others, I've discussed with them. And then we had a meeting before this last week, we had a meeting again. And when one looks at that sort of the draft bill that's out there, I made comments where the PBO input, I made the comment that the PBO input, simply so that they can actually explain whether there should be questions around that when you get to that point, Jefferson. So that is there. Just on the issue of the board, because PBO raised that issue as well, should we have a board that sort of manages the PBO? I think it's a good idea, Jim, but in law, as soon as you get board, people say, well, where is your article, where is your rules of procedure, who's the chair of the board, how does it work? So I try to convince them at this point in time that the article takes on the form of certain people manage or assist with managing of the PBO, chairperson and the relevant house chair.
We don't call them board.
No.
What do we call them? The committee that meets every now and then with the PO.
I
thought I'm a board member. I put it in my CV as a board member. I'm going to amend my CV now and say, and here we invite them.
Not for that one, this act one to say to you, and that's one of the questions and we'll come to the table. But it's like, just in a cycle, you have to follow all the steps in the cycle. The cycle is based, the meaning of the content of that cycle, money, the meaning of it, and that's what the Atma Creed is based on, oversight. So if we, as fallen, find that there are non-delivery or bad delivery, underperformance, that is fallen's conscience, and I like that. We say, well, let the money follow the solution, because we cannot be throwing money down this hole with it, non-performance. But as it stands at the moment, the cycle, we have an annual budget cycle. Other countries have a biennial cycle. The neutral offering is on the horizon. The 1 year job this year will only actually feature in the budget next year, will feature in the NTPS, will feature in the budget, will reach the act, provision requires that when the budget is introduced, the minister must respond to the reports on the NTPS and on the budget review and recommendation reports. But only at the budget on the it's responded to not the NTPS stage. Some suggested, but should the NTPS already respond to your oversight report? I'm personally feeling that I think there's enough time. I think it's fine that it is something that I want to put before ourselves at some point in keeping for myself. People have mentioned this issue. But it does fit into that. The PBO, there's no special place for the inner cycle. They advise Parliament, it's actually simply to advise Parliament on the budget cycle because we don't have that capacity in the normal administration of Parliament. And that advice, because it's sometimes very urgent and sometimes very critical, the research that was done prior to this bill being drafted, the initial bill and PBO being established, we went to a few countries, a very enjoyable time working in Parliament and then the travel trip. And from Korea, we went to Korea, Japan, I think we there, went to Sweden, went to Kenya, went to Germany. They all have dedicated functions within the Parliament. We all know about Canada, we all know about Congress. Even the states within America have their own budget office. So it's a dedicated function to advise on this annual or biannual, sometimes it's a longer period, to the country. Now, for this advice to be effective and efficient, you need also an administration that responds quite quickly. You need new equipment, or you need to go to specific training. Now, these issues are how that come forward. Now, when you say, well, yes, you are a special unit, but if you want a computer, or if you want training, you have to go, you stand in the supply chain management queue, and it might take 2 or 3 weeks to get approval, because of the amount of things that has to be done, the bureaucracy has to go through. Then you start signing the operations of this unit, of the PBO. And that is one of the issues that we deal with under the management of the PBO. Now, the way one part of that is the political oversight or political involvement, if I can use it that, we just heard of the advisory panel, that is the one which is much committed. Committees will not put that, as I say, not possible.
They recover
that. Yeah, we recover that. Now, to move on, so but now let's just see what is the appropriate accounting structure there. We've looked at the Financial Management Parliament Act, which set out the hardware ultimate charge of the oversight office, and the executive authority must report to the House. The funding office reports to the executive authority. We want to have a similar thing set up clearly for the PBO. Now, the issue of too many power reports or too wide a discretion for the executive authority, there is an amendment to the Financial Management Parliament Act, their role under the oversight mechanism, and I'm very aware of it. I don't think this is similar to that. This is really to make it clear, and this is happening in practice, for my that in any event, you're going to get the director to account and speak to the executive authority. And at this point in time, and I would like to, the PBO can give all the details of that argument. At this point in time, they do not have a separate budget in which the director can decide what he needs for what, according to an approved plan that is approved by the executive authority. The moment they're in between the accounting officer, saying, you can set this side for the PBO. Should you want to employ more people, should you want to travel, please follow our supply chain management processes. But by the way, they need to follow the normal supply chain management processes set up in the Constitution and the legislation, the broad-based economic empowerment act, and the preferential procurement policy framework, and the others. But the fact is, who does it? Are they in control of that? Or do they have to go to the Parliament administration and then maybe lose time or suddenly get a rejection from someone that
we agree on that, that we feel they should have some level of autonomy, but within Parliament's thing, you know, the thing is, actually, I know these issues because they keep coming up, and it takes very long to for Parliament to process. The best thing is, of course, the Parliament is so long. So I really think some level of autonomy is ready to go. I mean, here, with, I don't need to reply, please. The idea is just get an initial foreign out and speak to Charles and get a process first. So if you can quickly, snappily reply to the issues.
Chair, when I look at the introduction, I think I've dealt with most of the questions. What have you done for oriented advances? What's the issue of leukemia? The issue of introducing a role in the NGOP. Chair, if we set normal standards for provincial aid, which is still going to be 76 within the Canada, but I don't think that's my share. It's still the 76 legislation in Canada.
But basically, can we agree on the following, that we will, sorry, yeah.
Just asking, I think it's very important to mention, and actually, my colleague Neil and I discussed it. I think what one can do, and I believe we're on the projector, on the slide show, there could be a regulation making function, either the advisory board or the executive board.
Yes.
Usually it's the executive board, that can set up the more detail that you can't set up in the legislation about how, whatever it is that you want to put your regulation for, the operations of the PPO.
Thank you very much. I'll speak to Charlene, and we'll come back to you about how we're going to process this matter. Just very quickly, remember, tomorrow at 10 o'clock we've got the Stats South Africa here. Now, I spoke to Bridget last night again. I have something of a sincere regret of the committee that she has been, let's put it this way, knocked off her balance, as it were, literally and figuratively. And really, it's going to be quite a process for it to be fully functional again, but things are on the mend. However, she's not able to deliver a draft report. She's in fact very busy at the moment, as she thinks you. She's finishing now, she's going to have it by early afternoon, the overview of the budget of Stats SA. We'll get it sometime later today, right? Yeah, you'll contact her. So she's in no position to deliver a report to us. So I don't know when we'll vote on the report, but we're hoping to at least vote on one of the reports next Tuesday. Okay? But there's nothing we can do because we just have Bridget and nobody else. Having said that, thank you all.
Yes.
You're not going to be long, right? People come talk to you.